Back in the live studio, I'm Gina Kaufman, here with something entirely different. I'm talking today with author Rebecca Skloot. She wrote the book The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks, and she's speaking tonight as part of UMKC's Social Justice Series. If you have a question for Rebecca during this conversation, just give us a call at 816-235-2888. Hi, Rebecca.
Hello.
Your book starts with a quote from Elie Wiesel, and I'm going to read that for our listeners right now. It says, "We must not see any person as an abstraction. Instead, we must see in every person a universe with its own secrets, with its own treasures, with its own sources of anguish, and with some measure of triumph." How exactly do you think this quote sharpens the focus of the story of Henrietta Lacks?
Well, in a lot of ways, I think. But for me, I think one of the important messages of Henrietta Lacks' story is that there's a human being behind every cell line in a laboratory, and so much of science relies on cell lines. And, you know, this is where our future medications will come from and vaccines. And historically, scientists in the lab haven't necessarily thought of each individual cell line as a person that these cells came from, who might have had, you know, a life and opinions about what might happen with those cells. And often they just never even wondered where they came from, which was the case with Henrietta's cells. So that was a starting point for me, that it's so important for science in general to always keep in mind the individual as well as the larger science.
Let's make sure our listeners have the basics of Henrietta's story. She was an African-American woman with five children. She died of cervical cancer in 1951 at only 31 years of age. And she changed the future of medicine forever without, sadly, without her knowledge or permission. Can you explain that?
Yeah, so she was diagnosed with cervical cancer and went to Hopkins for treatment in Baltimore. And she went there because it was the only place she could go that treated black patients. You know, this was the era of segregation, and they had a colored ward there. And so she went there, and before treating her, without telling her, her doctor just cut this little piece of her tumor and put it in a dish. And he sent that down the hall to George Guy, who is the head of tissue culture research at Hopkins. And scientists all around the world had been trying to grow human cells outside the body for decades, and it had never worked. And for reasons that remained a mystery for many decades, her cells just never died. So they just took off and began doubling their numbers. And they really just changed so much of the foundation of medicine. They were used to help develop the polio vaccine. They went up in the first space missions to see what would happen to human cells in zero gravity. Her cells were the first ever cloned. Her genes, some of the first ever mapped. You know, we have our most important cancer medications thanks to her cells, like vincristine and tamoxifen. I can guarantee a lot of people listening to this have taken those. The HPV vaccine, in vitro fertilization. I mean, the list just goes on and on and on. And yeah, she had no idea, and neither did her kids until many, many years later.
You give some really incredible visuals for estimates of the huge number of what are called HeLa cells. Those are her cells in the world today. Like that, if you laid them end to end, this chain of microscopic HeLa cells would wrap the Earth at least three times. That is crazy.
Yeah. And one of my favorite ones of those is that one scientist estimated that if you could have saved them all and put them on a scale, that by now they'd weigh more than 50 million metric tons, which is more than 250 Empire State Buildings. You know, and cells themselves weigh almost nothing. So it's just, it's impossible to imagine how many cells we're talking about for me. It's just, it is amazing. And they were mass produced, sort of assembly line style at a certain point and sent around the world.
How did you first learn about Henrietta Lacks? You write about this scene in your community college biology class. Set that scene for us.
Yeah, so I was 16 years old, and I was in this biology class, and I was actually there because I failed my freshman year at the local high school, and I had to make up the credit, essentially.
Humble beginnings.
Yeah,
I like
hey.
It.
there is hope for all those kids out there who are struggling in school. And my teacher said what most biology teachers say at some point, which is, there are these amazing cells. He wrote Henrietta Lacks on the chalkboard and said, you know, they came from this woman, and she was a black woman. And then that was it. And he erased the board. And I was like, well, but what else do we know about her? And did she have any kids? And what do they think about all this? And I just had all these questions. And I went up to him, and he just said, sorry, nobody knows. You know, if you're curious, go see if you can find something. Write up a little thing. I'll give you some extra credit. You know, and that was, I don't know, 30 years ago, 28 years ago.
What are the really big questions that her story left you with initially? I mean, you wondered if she had kids and all these things, but underneath those questions is, I think, some bigger curiosity that you might not have even really understood yourself.
Oh, absolutely. I think there are a lot of different ones for me at that point in my life. So I was, I had been going through what my dad referred to affectionately as my Holocaust phase, which is that I had just sort of started discovering my family's history. So my father's side of the family were Jews, and many of them were killed in the Holocaust. And I had been reading all of these books about the Holocaust to just sort of learn about that side of my family.
Maybe and, even the one by Elie Wiesel that quote
absolutely.
Came from.
Yeah, no, he was a very influential one. I mean, I read Night over and over and over when I was a kid. And as part of that, I found my way to exactly that book, that's the information that was in that book, which was the Nazi Nuremberg or the Nazi doctors and the research they did on Jews. And so I'd been learning about that. And then that led me to, we'd been doing that in the United States with, black people for, centuries, essentially. And slaves were used in research without their knowledge. And so I was already interested in that area. And so I think part of it sparked that curiosity, but also that when I was 16, my father got very sick. He had got a viral infection in his brain that caused really severe brain damage. And he went from being sort of my marathon running dad, he's in his early 40s, to being this guy who couldn't move off the couch, and he lost most of his memories. And he ended up enrolling in a clinical trial for a drug that was experimental. And because of his brain damage, he couldn't drive. And I had just gotten my license. So one of my sort of chores as a kid was drive dad to the hospital 3 or 4 times a week and sit there and watch him go through this. And some of the stuff that he went through was really horrid. They had him running on a treadmill until he collapsed so they could see how long it would take for him to collapse and if he improved at all. And there were a lot of ethical questions that ended up coming up later about the trial. And I watched him going through this and all these other people who were in the trial. And so I think in that moment, sitting in that classroom, I think the reason that question came to me, did she have any kids and what did they think about this, was because somewhere in there, I think I was like, there are maybe other kids whose parents have been used in research and they've dealt with some of these things that I'm just starting to I don't even think I'd really started thinking about the impact it was having on me.
Yeah, but this issue of bioethics, I mean, this whole arena is not something abstract to you. It's deep
right.
and personal.
Yeah, as is the science. So I'm a big fan of science, too. And that I wanted to be a veterinarian. I was in that biology class because I was headed to toward medical studies and, that I really am a big believer in science. So I was coming at this as someone who had really intimate experiences sort of on both sides of this equation. And at the time, I didn't know that she hadn't given permission. I just knew there was this woman. We knew she was Black. That was it. And no one knew anything else about her. And I was just like, well, that just seems wrong. Like, we should know.
Yeah. And it seems like her story kind of followed you, maybe yeah. even haunted you through every step of your education after that. No matter what you studied, HeLa cells were there.
Yes, it's true. Which, in science is just the case. HeLa cells are sort of everywhere. But yeah, there was this, they just wouldn't let me go. And I would do the, extra credit papers on them in various biology classes. And I would just sort of, I did actually research on them in a lab that I ended up working on because I had no intention of being a writer until sort of very, very late in my college career.
How many years had you been preoccupied with this story before you reached out to her family? And how did it go when you reached out to them?
Yeah, so I first learned about Henrietta in 1988, and I first called her family in 99. So that was 11 years of being obsessed and wondering. And in that meantime, I had discovered writing and I had written stories about my weird obsession with Henrietta Lacks and these cells. And so I'd been aware of the fact that this was a story I sort of wanted to tell somehow. And then, when I called her daughter in particular, Deborah Lacks, I got her on the phone and she was really excited and she was like, this would be amazing. Someone, if the world could know about who my mother was and what she did. And then she said, but how do I know you're really a writer? How do I know you're not coming to steal my cells? And I was like, what? Why would you think I would be coming to steal your cells? And then she hung up on me and wouldn't talk to me for a year and a half. And I was the only thing I had no idea what her children had been through, which it turned out was a lot, up until the point that I called. And I just didn't know how I fit into their story. And so in that moment, all I knew was I have to figure out why she's afraid of me.
What had her children been through?
Yeah, so they learned about the cells in the 70s. So Henrietta died in the early 50s. And in the early 70s, in order to learn more about the cells, some scientists tracked down her kids in order to do genetic research on them, essentially, to take samples from them in order to learn more about the HeLa cells. And, her family didn't have a science education. Her husband had a fourth grade education. He didn't even know what a cell was. And he got this phone call, and essentially the way he understood it was, we've got your wife, she's alive in a lab somehow. And we've been doing research on her for the last 25 years. And now we have to test your kids to see if they have cancer. And it sort of sucked her whole family into this world of research that they didn't understand. And the scientists didn't realize they didn't understand because of various just communication problems. And it just sort of never stopped. And, you know, her kids' cells ended up being sent all around the world for research just like her cells had. Their genetic information was published without their knowledge. Their medical records were released to the press and published. The con artists had come along trying to steal their mother's medical records. And the things that had happened to them up until, you know, the point I came along were just no one could have imagined it. If I had written this as fiction, no one would have believed it because they were so much of it was just so incredible. And then I came along, yeah, hi, I want to write about your mother. And, you know, for them, I was just one in a long line of people who came to them wanting something, particularly white people, and it hadn't worked out very well and for them. And I didn't know any of that. So the only thing I knew in the moment that I called her and she hung up on me was I have to figure out what happened as much as I can so that I can explain to her, you know, so I can know what the story is and sort of try to win her trust.
The two of you did develop a pretty interesting relationship in spite of that rocky start. Yeah. Can you talk more about her, Deborah, the daughter of Henrietta Lacks, and your connection with her?
Yeah, she was an absolute force. So she had lived her entire life just in some way, really obsessed with wanting to know who Henrietta was and what her cells had done for science. And
totally natural, a child who loses a parent.
Right. And she was a toddler when her mom died, so she didn't know her. No one in the family talked about her, so she didn't even know really why she died. And she had actually lived in fear of her own 30th birthday because she thought she was going to die. And this is part of why the research that was done on the kids was so traumatizing. It happened right when she was about to turn 30, so she thought, this is them sort of confirming my worst fears. And, you know, so she had this incredible drive to learn and not a lot of resources to do it. She couldn't really read or write very well because all of Henrietta's kids were deaf or hard of hearing, and Deborah really couldn't hear her teachers in school. So she just didn't learn a lot of the basics and she also was in an inner city Baltimore school system, you know, in the 50s and 60s. And so she carried a basic dictionary around with her everywhere she went so she could look up words she didn't understand. She was in some ways my greatest hurdle to writing this initially. She really, you know, wouldn't talk to me. And then once she did begin to trust me, she would have these moments of getting scared and sort of backing off. But she was also sort of my greatest inspiration because I had never spent time with someone who had faced as many just difficult situations, you know, child abuse after her mother died, a lot of really hard things. And she just never let any of it stop her from what she wanted to do, which was learn and, you know, get information out about her mother. And that fight in her was really, you know, it was just sort of really inspiring to watch.
It must have been so interesting for you to have been obsessed with knowing this person's story and to meet someone else who, for her own separate reasons, more maybe direct reasons, is also has been obsessed with knowing more. And so you could become this team.
Well, that was the thing. I mean, we were, if you met the two of us, we were as unalike as two people could be. You know, I was a foot taller than her, you know, and you know, she's black, I'm white, she's really, there's just everything visually about us could not have been more different. But we shared a lot of things that I think were essential. And one of them was just absolute hard-headedness. And, you know, there's a reason, like, I got kicked out of almost every school that I went to as a kid. Like, I was this sort of, I'm going to do things my way. And so is Deborah. And she recognized that tenacity and that sort of hard-headedness. And she also recognized that she had sort of found someone, I think, who really understood her obsessive desire to learn about her mother, where, you know, her family was like, oh, you know, crazy Deborah, always wanting to, you know, talk about her mother. And I mean, they thought it was good that she wanted to learn about it. But to them, they just didn't have the same drive that she did to learn it. And so I think there was something in that. And she also knew about my father's, my history within my family. And to her, that, I think, was important. And, you know, there were a lot of questions along the way, you know, should she talk to a black writer? This is, you know, people had asked her this and should, you know, and I didn't have a lot of experience as a journalist. I had a science background and some people in her family were, you know, her life were like, you know, you're talking to a white person who has been in the sciences. Are you sure she's really who she says she is? And she basically was like, you know, well, no black writer has asked me to tell this story. And she also said, you know, I think from talking to her, she can learn about race. She can learn a lot of the things she needs to learn. But I don't think you can learn what it feels like to have a parent used in research, and she has that. And so I think for her, that connection and this sort of tenacity were really important.
Did the process of writing and researching this book leave you feeling more clarity than you started with on the ethical issues here, or in a more murky place?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know that I started with too much of a lack of clarity. I mean, I guess my position in all this has always been, it's, you know, the science is good and the science is important and we need to have this happen, but the laws haven't, you know, the sort of regulation of tissue research hasn't kept up. And I felt that way going in and I felt that way coming out. And it was clear to me, the thing that was clearer is how that happened. You know, why are the laws written the way they are now? Why haven't they changed? And you know, what needs to happen after that?
The book has been out for about 4 years now, and it's made a lot of waves. Has anything changed as a result of the conversation you've sparked? About a year ago, I think some things did actually start to shift.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's actually been almost 5 years now, which is really incredible.
Oh.
A lot has changed in that. I mean, this book is taught in basically every medical school, every research school. I think it's probably, you'd be hard pressed to go through a PhD program in or any science education without reading this at this point, either in high school, undergrad, or college, which is kind of amazing. And there are a lot of conversations about how do you do this science in a way that is, you know, kind of beneficial to science and also shares with people what they need to know in order to feel okay with the science. And that's what a lot of it's about. How do you communicate science to the people who are research subjects or the, you know, donating the tissues? So that has changed, I think, quite a bit as a discussion point. There was a revision proposed to the law that governs tissue research, and it's been fascinating. So there was these proposed changes that would have required, so the way it was written and now still is that, you know, if your name is attached to cells, then it requires permission to use them in research. But if you take someone's name off, they don't have to get permission. So most research is done without people knowing, and that, you know, there are a lot of questions about whether you can even anonymize cells. And so there were changes proposed to the law that would make it so you just had to get permission no matter what you were going to do with someone's tissues. And then the way these laws work is you propose these changes, they put them out for public comment. They did that, got this incredible flood of comments. This was like 2, maybe 3 years ago. And then you see a revision to the law sometime later and another open period for comment, and that just never happened. So it's like they proposed the changes. This is federal law. They proposed the changes and just got this flood of responses and then went, you know, and now it feels like there's been a sort of, because there's so many different opinions about it. There's so many reasons to be careful about not overregulating, but not underregulating.
And what are the concerns about overregulating?
Well, I think with overregulating, they just, you know, one of the big concerns is what's going to happen to all the stored samples, the millions and millions and millions of samples from people who don't know that they're stored and used in research.
So that you can't retroactively go back do the things that are being required.
Right. And people, scientists use those stored samples for a lot of really important things. And so how do you sort of deal with that? And then if you are going to get consent going forward, how do you get consent when you don't know what's going to happen in the future? You know, if you had told George Guy, these cells are going to be alive in 100 years, and we are going to be able to look in these cells in like 40 years and tell you detailed information about Henrietta's kids because of her DNA, which they didn't know existed at the time, or that they would be worth money.
He didn't have the knowledge.
And so, you know, but people understand that. People can wrap their heads around this. The future of science is unclear. Here's what we can do now. Here's what the potential risks are to you in terms of privacy. Are you okay with saying, for the good of science, I'm going to say I'm cool with where we are now and I am fine with, you know, a little bit of uncertainty? And almost everyone would say yes. And the problems come up just when you don't ask. And historically, there have been now since the book came out, there have been some studies that look at what is the public opinion about donating cells for research with consent. And something like 80-something% of people say they would say yes. And then the question is rephrased as how do they feel about research with cells and tissues without consent, it's something like 20% or so say.
Which actually seems kind of high.
Yeah. Well, and a lot of people are like, whatever, they're my cells. I'm not using them. I don't care. You know, so, and that's one of the things about this story. People often ask me, so what do you think? And I'm like, I don't feel like it's my job to tell people what to think in all this. It's, everybody's going to feel differently about how cells should be used, whether you care about it, you know, and a lot of it comes back to, you know, how do you think about life and your DNA and are you your cells? And, you know, for different people, that's very, it has a very big different meanings. And, you know, so my, I feel like my job is lay out all the information and to essentially say, discuss, everybody's going to feel differently about it, but do it with the facts.
When you go around the country giving talks, like the one you're giving in Kansas City tonight, how do your audience seem to respond to the story you're telling and the information you're bringing to light?
And it very, you know, people have a really powerful reaction to this. And I think, you know, and I sort of knew that all along. I knew if I could just get this story out to people, they would respond in a sense the way I did, which was, oh my God, I have to tell people about this. You know, it's just such an incredible story. And I think some of the emotional responses that I get in these events come from the fact that there's not a single person out there who hasn't personally benefited from these cells, whether it's just from getting a vaccine or taking a certain cancer drug, you know, their kids being born through IVF, like whatever it is, you know, and now it's been long enough so that most college audiences, a lot of kids in the room are actually alive because they were conceived with technology that was used to, you know, developed with HeLa cells. And so I think that personal investment in the story is something that really makes people think about this it in a different way and is important for, that's what I think is important with science, is people have a very hard time imagining, why should I care about cells? You know, cells, whatever. When I used to tell people, what are you doing? I'm writing a book about the first immortal human cell line. They'd go, oh. Like, no, it's interesting, really. And I think, you know, that's part of it is sort of the humanizing of the cells, but also making it personal for the readers.
Have you been asked questions or told stories that have surprised you?
Yeah, I'm sure I have. And I just, the number of them, you know, I did, so this is now, I'm almost at year 5 since the book came out, and I have been doing, the first year that the book came out, I did over 400 speaking events. There were sometimes
wow.
I did 3 in a day, and we just, I didn't imagine the interest, and then the next year it was like 200 something, and I've been sort of trying to kind of rein it in a bit just to not become this, you know, lose my mind standing up on a stage nonstop talking. And so, yeah, the stories that I've heard, the you know, people showing up and just telling me, you know, this is how these cells saved my life. And I want to say thank you for telling me the story and thank the Lax family for, you know, for these cells. And I'm sorry what they went through. And scientists coming, standing up and telling stories about what they've done with them. Yeah. And then just people coming with strange things. They want me to say, I had one woman who came with a big picture of her a cyst that they had removed from her ovaries. And she asked me to sign it. And she had, I think somebody else brought me a Petri dish with their cells growing and they wanted me to sign that. And, you know, so I think, you know, people really just want to share the different ways that somehow their lives relate to the cells, which is great.
Are they relating to the cells, or do you think that their interest is partly a connection to this woman you've profiled?
Oh, all of it. I think Henrietta, her family, for sure, and also the, you know, the cells somewhat. I think there's this idea of they realize, you know, people really want to understand science. They really want to connect with it. They just don't get that many opportunities. The general public doesn't. And I think for them, the idea of like, oh, I understand how cells had this impact on my life and this woman who I didn't know. So they get very excited about all those different aspects.
What are you researching now?
So I'm writing a book about that I still haven't quite figured out how to explain, but it is about animals and the many roles that they play in our lives, and in some ways very similar sort of questions about, you know, the, in a sense, where you draw the line between science and, you know, the research subject. So some of it touches on research on animals and our relationships with them. When I was in undergrad, so before I started writing, I was planning to be a veterinarian, and I worked in the morgue at the vet school. And there was a pretty formative experience that happened to me there where I was seeing, in a sense, all the end result of the teaching and research. This was at a time when they were using greyhounds from the local racetrack to teach vet students how to do pretty basic surgeries. And sometimes they were going through hundreds of them in a week. And I was seeing all this stuff and thinking, like, really, this is how many dogs, animals we have to go through every week to do research and teach, you know, veterinarians how to do research and or how to do surgeries. And so I started asking these questions about where do you draw the line between science and the things you need to help make it go, essentially.
Rebecca Skloot, it's been a pleasure speaking with you today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Rebecca is the author of The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks. She's speaking this evening at UMKC's Pearson Auditorium. When Central Standard returns, we'll turn our attention to found footage, hilarious artifacts of time gone by, this immortalized on videotape. I'm Gina Kaufman. Don't go away.